Welcome to Elevate. I'm so happy you're here with me today, and I cannot wait to share this episode with you. As an evidence-based coach, mentor, and entrepreneur, I'm obsessed with learning and personal development as it's transformed my entire life, as well as those I get to work with. And to be quite frank, it's literally the entire reason this podcast exists, to fuel your growth, gain perspective, and acquire knowledge. So buckle up, friends, you're in for a treat. And as always, thank you for supporting me and the show so we can continue to elevate our own lives as well as those you share this with. Now, let's get into it.
Hello.
How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. How have you been? It's been too long.
I know. Good. I mean, crazy always. I mean, life's always a little bit nuts, but but good overall.
That's an
what about you?
I had finals, and this semester, I feel like every semester going forward is going to enhance the level of difficulty, which is fun for me, but this one was a lot. Obviously, I had site visits, I had to work in clinical practice, I had to do interviews. It was just a lot of stuff, but good stuff. I got a 93 in the class, so I was pumped about that. So I was like, cool. And then next semester is diagnostics, which will be fun.
Oh, yeah, a blast.
No, you're like, I mean, oh.
You know what's interesting is there's fun parts to it. Like, and then there's always also the added stress of the responsibility and getting it in on time. And, you know, it's a lot.
Well, what I find very interesting is obviously in my first master's, we had to do a lot of research stuff. And so I'm very familiar with like writing research papers. The level of research I have to do now is just way different. And because it's different than what I'm used to, it feels more complex because the way that it's measured or the way that they test certain things is like not like it is with physiology. And we're just like seeing things and it's easy to kind of titrate through that. When you're looking at the cognitive emotional stuff, it's different, interesting, and I've learned a lot, but still the complexity of the human mind is something that is very fascinating, but also it's still so new. So it's like, we really don't know that much as we think that we do know. I think that there's so many layers of depth with it that it's exciting to me because I don't think within my lifetime we'll really understand the human mind.
No, I mean, who knows if we'll ever fully understand it. I mean, same is true as in medicine. Like when you get deep into certain medical things, you realize there's a lot we know, there's a ton we've learned, and a lot of it is just really educated guesswork. And I think the first time anybody has a medical issue that while trying to figure out what it is, it just kind of resolves. And then you have providers who are like, okay, great. And you're like, what do you mean great? And they're like, well, let us know if it comes back. And you're like, but we don't know what it was. And they're like, yep, okay, but we made sure it wasn't anything catastrophic. And the first time that happens is I know we've talked about that whole shattered assumptions idea where you're like, wait a second, what? Like we're just good. We have no idea, but we're just going to stick with it. Like,
we don't know why certain things work, but they work. Which is kind of a great segue into what I want to talk about today, which is coping mechanisms, because I think life, this is my own kind of beliefs, and I am interested to hear your clinical perspective, but also like the things that you've seen over the time that you've been doing this. I tend to look at life as just one big cope, and then the way that we move through it is either adaptive or maladaptive, right? But we're all, I think, trying to cope with the peaks and the valleys that life throws at us. Like you've pointed out to me previously, and I'll share a little story aligned with this too, because I've been thinking about it a lot mostly recently, is that I tend to intellectualize everything. I try to think from a problem-solving position, which can negate some of the emotional elements of being able to process certain things. But I was doing some investigation of this because I was trying to intellectually understand the mental gymnastics that I go through sometimes. And I found this therapist who was talking about this, and what they were discussing was that IQ can also present itself as people who may be like misunderstood, or they tend to have higher proclivities to addictions and those types of things because their complexity of mind is really difficult for people in the normal IQ average range to be able to understand sometimes, and that can leave them into a position where they feel more isolated. So inevitably with diagnostics and clinical practice, I have access to all these things. So I was like, let me take an IQ test. Cause like Jordan's giving me shit. He's like, the reason that you're single and will be single is because your IQ is too high. So I was like, I need evidence. Of course, me being me, I'm like, I need evidence to support that claim. So I took an IQ test, and it came back and I have a 133 IQ. And I was like, okay, there's some validity to some of these things. And then you pair that with ADHD. And one of the therapists was saying, some people don't actually have like a high level of ADHD, but with the complexity of mind, they can engage with ADHD style behaviors. So all of that to say, like some of my coping mechanisms, I do think are overriding some of the experiences that I had where I had to depend on my brain to solve problems at a young age. And I think that's become a safe zone for me to move through life, leveraging my brain capacity, but then also looking at some of the outside factors and how that impacts some behavior as far as like isolation or not necessarily being able to feel comfortable communicating my feelings or the vulnerable, the ability to label and understand the emotional experience that I'm having. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that. And then we can dive into some of the layers of coping.
Oh, so many thoughts. Well, for one, just to save any of your listeners the time looking it up, just for frame of reference, most IQ tests, or kind of the IQ test that's most often used, at least for a neuropsych or a psych assessment, the average range is going to be between 90 and 110, or it might be between like 90 and 109 or something like that, because at some point they realized you can't have one category go 90 to 110 and then the next category will go 110 to 120. But just because I'm sure there are people who are going, you know, okay, well, what would that actually equate to? But, you know, it's so interesting because I think that intelligence and intellect and skill set and coping mechanisms and sensitivity and awareness, and they all play a role. They all play a role into how does that translate for any one individual in their functioning. So that's why, like, when you hear people say, oh, somebody was intellectually very bright, but they don't have street smarts, you know, or they don't have common sense. Well, that person is going to run into different challenges than somebody who has a high IQ and a lot of common sense or problem solving. Is going to be different than somebody with a high IQ, high problem solving, but high anxiety versus somebody who has those two, but then has an inflated ego. Right? So one of these variables alone isn't going to equate to, okay, so what does that mean in terms of functioning, life, relationships, stressors? For some people, it's where that phrase or comment like of ignorance is bliss. If you run into somebody where it's like, hey, yep, they've hit just that sweet spot of they're actually not very aware of a lot of these dynamics, right? They're not aware of all of the things that are going on or the relationships around them, how those relationships could impact them, how that, if they're not aware of it, well, then they can walk out of a meeting, an interaction. They can walk away from a text thread with friends and be like, oh, okay, cool. We figured out where we're going to dinner. Whereas somebody else who more is very, very socially or emotionally aware might say, hey, I know these two friends are pissed at each other. But so you're going to dinner. One person might show up to dinner like, great, I'm so glad we figured out where to go. And another person might show up going, oof, all right, I'm thinking about the whole night and how long are we going to be out? Because I know these two people were really upset about how that went down. And, you know, let me reach out to each one of them. I want to make sure they both, but you have two people. So IQ alone isn't actually going to indicate how that impacts their experience of the world or relationships. So what you need for coping strategies is different, because that one friend might be incredibly bright and high functioning and, you know, even have street smarts, but not have that, you know, kind of sensitivity or what we often call like empath or empathy, or they'll go out to that same dinner with not a care in the world, not having any idea that the text exchange could have created all sorts of drama.
And what's interesting about that is one of the things that I know I don't know. So one of the things, this is going to bring me on so many tangents. Okay. Back to what I was originally going to say is that there's IQ, which tends to support how you will perform intellectually in certain capacities. But then there's EQ, and that tends to be a stronger correlation to overall life success as far as relationships and kind of the intimacy that you can build within a construct of a community or a family home or nurturing relationships, those types of things. I think that you can be strong in both. I think where I have an inclination to understand, and I think other people might be able to relate to this, is I'm strong as far as assessing other people's emotions. I'm very good at reading a room. However, it's more of the having the insight upon my own emotions that I don't feel I have great clarity on, because if you were to ask me how I feel right now, genuinely, I don't necessarily know. Even when I'm upset, I don't know if I'm like angry or sad, or I just feel kind of numb to it. And then I just think about, okay, well, what do I need to do? And that tends to be how I move through things. And again, when I'm looking at coping, I would say I'm more of problem solving / action taking versus the somatic side of understanding how do I feel and validating my own feelings. And that's the rift that I have as far as an internal conflict as to like, one, is that even bad? Is it bad that I don't know? Is that necessary for me to learn? I'm not entirely certain. And so sometimes because of the internet and the vast array of information that we're exposed to, sometimes I hear people talking about stuff and it sounds very interesting, but at the same time, I have to pause and ask myself, like, is it necessary for me to go down the path to learn that skill? Is there an actual reward on the other side of it? Is it going to benefit me in some certain ways? How is that going to impact me moving forward? Is it positive or is it a waste of time? I'm not entirely certain. And I don't mean to dismiss it from like saying it's a waste of time. I do think it can be important to understand how the fuck you feel. Probably improves communication. But I find myself trying to have some level of discernment with the rabbit holes that I expose myself to going down.
And so that's the intellectual side, right? That's the desire to know. I think probably some of that, and now more talking to about you or your specific presentation, right, is because you have both. You have these dueling components, right? You have the intellect, the desire to figure it out, work it through, but you also have the emotional component, and they're dueling. They're trying to figure out, okay, wait, I have a feeling, I have a gut, I have an instinct, but also why? Why do I have that gut? Why do I have that instinct? You know, and for some people, you know, they don't go into that internal battle. Some people are, you know, I mean, that's, you know, it's funny because I'm recording with Jordan and we're talking about kind of the Myers-Briggs and personality style and personality traits. And it gets right into that, right? Because for some people, when you have both, they default. So for some people, they're like, oh, I have a very strong pull towards, if I'm not sure, I default to the intellectual. I'm just going to choose what makes sense. Some people, much more on the emotion side, and they're like, well, this feels right. And some of these personal style inventories, or it used to be called a personality test, it's not anymore. But what they're getting at is that it's a range. So this one particular test that I like to use, because it has a very high correlation rate with the Myers-Briggs, but without, it's like 32 questions. So you can fill it out in like 10 minutes, but it has like no lie scales. So if you're not honest, you won't get an honest response. But it breaks each of these categories, like introversion and extroversion, on, you have a total of 50 points, and it will give you how much do you land on either side. If you are fairly balanced, right? So if perception versus judging, right? Those are two of the categories. Some people might be like 45-5, right? So if they're a 45-5 split on perceiving, then they are going to just go on their gut. They're going to go on their emotion 95% of the time, you know, and they're not going to go based on hold on them. But if you fall into like a 25-25 category, well, then what that means is sometimes you're driven by the logic, the fact, and other times you're driven by emotion, but it means that you see both of them equally, which is going to be exhausting because you may be switching to like almost like a, you know, 26-24, then like 26-24 the other direction, then 30-20, then 25-25. So when you're evenly balanced, it means that you are assessing not just the data or not just the emotional or gut or intuition, and different people in different ways. Same thing with introversion and extroversion. Somebody who is a natural extrovert, if they are if I took one of those tests, or well, I did when I was in college, I was unhealthy balanced towards extroversion. Like I would have been like 49-1, right? So social choices weren't tough. If somebody was like, hey, you want to go do this? Yep. Right? Because why not? Are there people involved? I'm going. You know, I know it's a little ridiculous. That has changed over time. And I'm much more evenly balanced. I will always be on the extrovert side. But I've become much more of an introverted extrovert. So I'm naturally an extrovert, but over the years and time and like that has altered somewhat. So I'm still an extrovert, but the decision making is very different now. It used to be very easy for me. I mean, like the joke I always use is that I think in high school I went to 9 proms. With friends in different towns that were like, I want to go and have fun. And I was like, what do I care if I don't know anybody? Sure, I'll go like with one of my best friends and like have a blast and dance and hang. Didn't care. I was like, sure, why not? Now, if somebody was like, hey, there's this fundraiser, it's Black Tie, do you want to go? I would be like, ugh, are you kidding me? To like go and have to just talk to random people I don't know. But that's not how it used to be. It changes. And when they change, different situations, different circumstances, you can find yourself somewhat exhausted at times because you're like, I don't know which one to go with.
So this is interesting to me because Jordan actually made me take the Myers-Briggs test because I had like not taken it before. And so I took it and I was like, I'm an INFJA. And he's like, oh, that makes perfect sense. And I'm like, I don't even know what that means. But he like understood it completely. He was like, yep, that's what I thought. And I'm like, okay, cool. Like, but I didn't take the time to actually break it down or examine it. It means I'm like an advocate or something. But I think it's interesting that you brought that up because you made me take that. And I was like, okay, mm-hmm. I'm a quiet visionary, often serving as inspiring and tirelessly an idealist. I'm not sure how that breaks down as far as like the manifestation of obviously my personality, I guess. But I think that that's an interesting thing. Do you find that personality tests are insightful or do you think... And maybe it's just because I overanalyze a lot of things, but do you think people can overanalyze themselves based on a personality test? Because that's why I didn't dive into it. I'm like, how much of this am I going to start judging myself upon? I don't know.
I love them because I think that like everything, it just gives you information. It just gives you information about how you approach something or how your default is. I used to use them for team building exercises or things like that, even just to help people understand that how you see or approach something may be very different than how other people do. I did a variation of a personal style inventory like years ago, and it was the first time I realized that probably at that, like I was in college at the time, I was an RA, like, you know, residential assistant, like. And we did like a very shortened version that basically split you into like 4 colors or numbers. So it was the first time I realized that when I ran a meeting, anybody who was on an introvert category likely hated me. Because I was like, great, let's just let it go in whatever direction. You know, and if something comes up, like, let's go there. And if something, it was the first time that I was like, I need to make an agenda. I need to show up so some of the people that in this group like can look at it and know what we're talking about and know if we're making progress. I didn't used to do that until I was like, oh, letting it just be free form and having it be like an unstructured hour of brainstorming is torture for some people. And
have you ever taken so Jordan Peterson, I love him. He's like one of the first people that really introduced me to psychology. And he has a personality test on his website that I've taken. And it's very interesting because it breaks down the personality dimensions and it shows you what they are on a sliding scale. So it's like out of 100 people or out of 1,000 people, like you would be this percentage within the group of displaying this level of personality. And this is what it would look like, which I found like super interesting for me. I also thought it was really funny. I'm like on the lower, I'm only 9% on the neuroticism scale. So it's like minimal amount of emotional kind of dysregulation. And I don't know if that's, I don't label things as good and bad. They just are. But I found that one to be super insightful because it's like level of agreeableness. Like I would have thought I'm more agreeable than I actually am. Like if I were to describe myself on a level of agreeableness, I would have put myself higher than I am. But then openness, I was like super high. So it was interesting to see how those things came together for me. And then obviously like this one, I need to dive into understanding it, but I'm sure it will carry over some of those personality traits. I feel like we're taking a segue into personality, which is also very interesting to me. But I would be interested to know, like when you're looking at personality traits, I'm actually going to pull up my test. I think I have it. But what dimensions do you think make up a healthy personality versus, I mean, we can obviously see things that move more towards more toxic personalities, but then we're going to get into like the dark triad and the dark tetrad, which is again, super fascinating to me. But how would you, one, my first question around personality is how far can you change it, right? Like if you work on these skills, if you work on building awareness, if you work on better coping skills, if you work on, you know, not necessarily catastrophizing things and being able to logically kind of troubleshoot and problem solve things, how much does that shift a personality on the scale? Because I don't think you can flip from like no neuroticism to being like highly neurotic or highly neurotic into like no neuroticism, kind of like shifting from being highly narcissistic to like lowly narcissistic. You probably can only move to like a moderate position if I had to guess, but I'm interested to hear what your experience is with personalities. And as you build skills, whether it's through therapy or some type of coaching, how that can impact those behaviors or temperaments manifesting in a lower degree.
We could spend weeks on this, and the question becomes like, I am so torn in what direction to go right now, because on the one hand it's the general conversation. And then the other is like my desire to take your specific test and break it down. And so I'm trying to decide which direction to go, because what you were just saying, you know, in kind of no particular order, and then I'll come back to some of the other questions, was when you were saying, you know, some of the rigid component, right? So you said you were an INFJ, right? And for anybody listening, the Myers-Briggs basically has 4 different dimensions. And the first one is introversion and extroversion, right? Those are the two scales. That's either an I or an E. The second part is intuition or sensing, which is an N or an S. And then it's thinking versus feeling and perceiving versus judging. So an INFJ means that you came out on introversion, intuition, feeling, and judging, right? Now, judging is not like a, but so that's where, you know, it then will give you, like the one that I have has this grid of 16 different personality styles or types. And if you think about it, each one of those can be weighted differently. So somebody could be an INFJ and they are very strongly an INFJ. Somebody else could be an INFJ, but is like barely an INFJ and could also be an INFP. And I'm going to lose all of the listeners because I'm just throwing out letters like, but what you are talking about is you have it's not just one variable, it's all of them and how they combine and the subtlety of those differences. So that last letter, if we just look at that, perceiving versus judging, the personal style inventory that I like to use that is based off of the Myers-Briggs, here's their definition of how they separate these. The judger is more decisive, firm, and sure, setting goals and sticking to them. The judger wants to close books, make decisions, and get on to the next project. When a project does not yet have closure, judgers will leave it behind and go on to new tasks and not look back. So that's where you're getting that, like, I want to know, I want to do, I want to decide. The perceiver, the way they list that out, is a gatherer, always wanting to know more before deciding, holding off decisions and judgments. But as a consequence, the perceiver is open, flexible, adaptive, and is able to see and appreciate all sides of issues. And it goes on to just say that, but they tend to be indecisive, non-committal. You know, that they can get involved in a task, even if there is no real closure, they can get frustrated. Even if they finish a task, they tend to keep looking back and wondering whether or not they had done. So I would bet on the version I have, and I'm going to send it to you so you can fill it out. I would bet that you're likely fairly balanced on the perceiving versus judging, because depending on the scenario, it can put you in a different headspace. So there are limitations to these, you know, these exams, because if you fill it out and think about, okay, how am I at work? It'll come out one way. If you think about it, how am I socially? It might come out slightly differently. That's not how most of these tell you to fill them out. Most of them will say, just think about in general, in all settings, like what do you think is most appropriate for you, like kind of more globally. But you can move from one of these categories to another. So typically with this spectrum, they'll say, like, look at where it came out and look at all the ones right around it. All of those are also going to have some traits that fit because they're one category away from where you're at. So some of these things change over time. They change depending on the scenario. They change depending on a relationship. They change depending. Some things are a little bit more ingrained. And in terms of changing them or not, I guess that's where I would go in the direction of what's the goal? What's the, like, thinking through, hey, if this is just my personal style, why am I immediately trying to fight against it? Why am I immediately trying to ask myself, can I change it? As opposed to saying, all right, this helps me see my strengths, some of my challenge areas, some of the areas that communication might be easy, some of the areas, this inherent desire to say, like, well, but if I have a trait or something, I have to fix it. I have to change it. I have to alter it. Well, or you have to understand it. You have to understand how that impacts, how it shows up, where that might make it so you have struggles or difficulties. You don't always have to say, like, right, if this one isn't coming out the way I want, how do I immediately kind of hammer at it and change it or make it something different?
I'm just trying to understand. So let's say somebody, like I said, the one that stands out to me, like, you could maybe put this under, like, agreeableness, like people who are like 99% agreeable, like where they don't necessarily ever tend to think about what they need or the boundary they need to set or saying no, like always appeasing the opinions of other people at the sacrifice of the self. I feel it would be empowering to that individual to learn to say no or to set a boundary. Not that they, but then they will probably have an internal emotional conflict of like, that was a bad thing to do, or that was not right, or that makes me selfish. And then it's kind of the cognitive reframing around their perception of the experience, because it's not like you want to turn into an asshole. That's like, fuck off everybody, don't talk to me. But at the same time, understanding, like, when we reach burnout, especially as a therapist, we see this all the time. We actually had to take a class on burnout, which I thought was really interesting. But therapists will burn themselves out because they're constantly serving other people and taking on their emotions and showing up and kind of not really assessing how they feel or, you know, working through something that happens with a client. And so I think I'm just trying to, if I could build like the perfect human, which is impossible, but you would want them to be able to navigate the intricacy of being compassionate and agreeable and supportive to other people without taking it to the point where you completely dismiss the fact that you exist. Because the number of women that I will work with, it's amazing to me how many of them forget they exist. And I use that language because, one, I felt that way of like, I'm here, but I don't feel anything about being here, almost like dissociation. And the number of parents specifically, but women more within that that arena of that emotion or feeling that experience, I find heartbreaking. And so it's not losing sight of the empathy or compassion or support that they have, but also learning that their needs are valid and it's okay to say no to something or to create space for themselves. So that's what I mean about like sliding those scales. I think understanding it is important and having the awareness is important, but then shifting the way that that navigates. Because if you play that through the end of the story, it's like, if you're always saying yes and dismissing your needs and saying, it's not that big of a deal. This is a stupid need. That's a stupid feeling. Don't listen to it. Put it away. You have to cope with it in some manner, right? And then we get into kind of more emotional or escaping coping mechanisms like drugs, alcohol, sex, pornography, whatever that might be for the individual, to just feel either nothing or something positive before they go back to the reality that they don't necessarily integrate themselves into, because they don't feel like they are there or their feelings are valid or that they exist in the complexity of their life.
It's like, I'm not trying to sound like, you know, corny about it, but like, it's a very deep question, right? That we're posing. And I guess in my mind, and this is just my own take on it, some of the problem stems from that very notion of what is the ideal person? What is a perfect person? There is no perfect person. It doesn't exist. And so that idea is partially what I think triggers a lot of these internalized problems, is the idea of, right, well, then if I don't know how to become the perfect person, then I need to look outward. I need to look to others to see how my interactions, my behaviors, my choices, my presentation impact others. Because otherwise, how will I figure it out? And I guess in some ways, I would argue the closest to perfection any of us will ever get is trying to strip away some of the bullshit and figure out, who are you and what do you like and how do you gain comfort with who you are? That's what gets people to that close feeling of like, wow, they're amazing. The people that you want to be around are the ones where you're like, wow, they are just comfortable in their own skin. They know who they are. They know what they want. And they might not like the things I like. They might, doesn't matter. You want to be around them. Because they just have something. They have something there. And a lot of that just comes from saying like, right, perfect is be who you are. Figure out what you want. Figure out what's important to you. I think sometimes, I don't know, self-confidence isn't going to build from how other people see you, right? Self-confidence builds when like you are happy with who you are, not other people. And I think that partially what you're describing is what we've talked about before, is often described as an empath, or I will describe as being a natural accommodator, a desire to bring kind of the most good or most positivity to whatever group you're in. How can I make whatever we're doing better, easier for the group? So for somebody who's a natural accommodator, they very often skip over a step of asking themselves, what do I want? What do I feel? Right? They skip to what would be best for the group, what would be best for the person I'm interacting with. So it's a learned pattern of not actually doing the work or taking the time to figure out, what do I want? And so when you said, if somebody asked you, how do you feel right now? I think when you ask somebody that, it almost triggers like an internal sequence. It like sets off a, like an internal computer program, but everybody's program is different. For a natural accommodator or an empath, I picture that if somebody says, how do you feel? Their initial response internally is, why are you asking me that? Not out loud, but internally, they're like, why are they asking how I feel? Right? So the immediate response isn't a look inward. Oh, how am I feeling right now? It's a look around of, why are they asking me? What's going on? What do they really want to know? What's the question? Like, what are they getting at? Like, are they upset and they're asking, are they uncomfortable and they're asking because they want me to? You're immediately assessing what brought that up, why, and what answer are you looking for? Right. So, because if somebody says, how are you feeling? And if you respond, like, and if you respond, and sorry, I caught myself off a little there, because I don't know if we've ever talked about the fact that my doctoral research, not my master's research, but my dissertation was looking at at emotional development in kids.
No, and we've never talked about this. And it's perfect timing because I was literally going to bring up the ACEs study because we had to do a whole thing on this. And it honestly rocked my world, like a little bit. And so I would love to hear that. But what's interesting about something that you said that I think is something that I've been exploring within myself. Again, I try to really take the information that I learned and kind of implement it within myself and assess how that makes me feel or how that changes my perspective in certain domains of how I function. But what's interesting is within the ACEs study, which I'm sure that you know this, that's essentially childhood adverse experiences that kids face. And when I think of adverse childhood experiences, I'm thinking abuse, I'm thinking sexual assault. The largest number of adverse experiences that children have are between the ages of 0 and 3, and the biggest one is neglect, which totally rocked my world. But on the other side of that, when it comes to high performers, people that tend to perform at a high standard, what happens in those individuals' lives, and I know that it's multifaceted and there's so many layers to this onion, but they tend to spend their lives, like you said earlier, chasing an outside authority's approval. And so the goalpost is always moving and there's always a carrot dangled into their in front of their face and they're willing to chase it because if then maybe my human experience will be validated, I'll be worthy of something. And it's interesting for me to look back on my life and I do feel as though just even like the frame of chasing an invisible authority, that's problematic because you never know who it is. But I've even expressed this to close friends. It's like, I don't know if I'll ever be enough. Like, I feel like I push myself to achieve all these things. And then I look back and I'm kind of like, the goalpost has moved again. And it becomes this hamster wheel of continuing to chase things and run this race until you realize these aren't things you actually want. These aren't things that you find meaning in. This isn't the direction of your life in which you find fulfillment. And then having the courage to change your mind because you understand where your needs, wants, desires, vision actually align to, which for me, 5, 6 years ago was one of the hardest things I ever had to do. But it's interesting to hear how all of these things manifest because I feel like trauma has become a buzzword and it does have meaning. But looking at how that can play out is, especially for people you would never know. You would never know some of the high level athletes that I've worked with in the NFL and the NBA. Like they all have these identity integrated into performance type structures that give them validation of their own existence because their performance or skills have utility and that's what they're known for. So when you lose that, you get into this really kind of rock bottom place where then you hear about NFL players going broke all the time. They have millions of dollars and they spend it on drugs, partying, whatever. And it's heartbreaking because that's how they're trying to, I'm speculating here. I don't know, but of the ones that I know who have gone through certain situations like this, it's mostly because they don't know who they are without what they do. And I find that that drives this rift. But then there's also this cultural, specifically in men, where they're like not allowed to feel. They're not allowed to cry or be weak. And then women say, men don't know how to communicate. I think they do know how to communicate. They just communicate differently than women do. They usually present as anger or mad, frustrated when they're like heartbroken and they need connection or compassion or whatever it might be. But it's like asking for that need. I don't know. I'm going in a million different directions because my brain is on fire right now. But so, yeah, go.
So let's look at it this way, right? So that's why I think these personality tests or personality style inventories are so fascinating. Because it's not just about that one thing, right? You can add in gender, then you can add in which one of those 16 personality types do you primarily present as, then you add in life experience, then you add it, like, and it's always going to show up slightly differently. But so in terms of trying to cover all the things that we've brought up, so the research that I did was looking at when do kids develop the ability to have a mixed emotional response towards the same target. So the classic example is that, you know, when a kid gets a present, they're happy. And if it's something they didn't want, that they can be both happy and sad. At a certain age, when kids are young, they default to one emotion. They just, I'm either happy or I'm sad, right? So that's where, like, you know, a kid will come back from a birthday party where they went to the movies and a parent says, how was it? And they say, it was awful. Why? Well, I dropped my popcorn. It's like, what? But then you find out then they just were given another popcorn and the rest of the day was spectacular. But that one thing, they're just like, then it was bad. And the question was, at what age do they start to develop the ability to say it was some good and some bad? And the other thing that we looked at is, do they develop that skill set for themselves or perceiving it in others, and which comes first? And kids are able to recognize that somebody else has a mixed emotional response before they can acknowledge it in themselves. Makes sense. But also, when you're working with kids, you realize how over time we distort what it is when somebody just says, how are you feeling? What's going on? It triggers a million different thoughts of how am I supposed to answer? What do you want? And the best example I have of it is, you know, I was basically, I don't want to bore you with the details of my dissertation, but I was interviewing kids about a video that they had watched and asking if they could identify if they had an emotional response and if the character had an emotional response. If they gave one emotion, I had a prompt and would say, did you feel anything else? And this cute little kid, I mean, he was just like, you know, like almost storybook cute. Like, so I asked him how he felt, and he was like, happy. And I was like, great. Did you feel anything else? And he goes, yeah. And then just stops talking, which is, and I'm like, well, what else did you feel? And he thinks, and he goes, I feeled hot, because the office we were in was hot. And it had not occurred to me that when I ask a question about how do you feel, that that doesn't just mean emotionally, right? And I almost had to fight laughing, right? Because what he answered was spot on. I said, did you feel anything else? He felt hot. And he shared it with me. So that's what he told me. He wasn't like, well, what is Josh actually asking me? Oh, well, it must be about emotion. Oh, well, it must. That comes as we get older and we understand the nuance. And like, for somebody who's a natural accommodator, if somebody says, how are you feeling? The first thing that's going to go through a lot of their head is, well, where's that person? What are they doing? What could they handle? Because what if I'm feeling sad, but they can't handle that? Well, if I'm feeling sad, but I know they're having a tough day, well, then I might say, I'm doing great. How are you doing? Right? Because it's like, oh, I know you're asking me that because you want to tell me some stuff that's going on. I don't want to. So we convolute all this. We don't answer it. And in time, I think for a real accommodator, you start to lose sight of, oh, I keep skipping that step of asking myself how I feel. And instead, I'm asking the person in front of me, or I'm trying to pick up on these cues to figure out what's going on. What's the like, you're trying to almost stay ahead of it. And then that whole notion of, you know, you said before, you know, that feeling of like, will I ever be enough? I think a lot of people struggle with that. And anytime I work with somebody who's basically like, hey, whatever it is, where they're just like, I constantly feel like I'm striving for the next step, and I just don't know that I'll ever be enough. I very often will go in the direction of saying, okay, well, first off, let's, like, we go through the whole conversation of what perfection is and that it's an ever moving target and you'll never get there. And then a lot of times what I'll say to people is, okay, so what if you'll never hit your own internal view of being perfect, your own internal view of being enough? Okay, so what would it mean to say, you know what, I'd like to continue to strive. I'd like to continue to try and improve. And I understand I may never hit that target, so I may as well enjoy what I do have. I may as well enjoy, you know, what I do bring to the table. I may as well give myself credit for the achievements I've made, for what I do, all under the auspice and understanding of, and I would like to get to some sort of better. And I get that it might be my cosmic torture that my whole life I will always feel like I'm out of reach of it. But okay, it's a burden to live with. But why does it have to be binary? Why does it have to be I've either reached it and can finally have peace, or I have to live in constant strain and torture? Why can't you say, right? Like, if you use a house as an example, you know how many people I know who live in an apartment, a house, and they're like, ah, oh, I know it's not perfect. I want to change this. I want to change that. Some people are hardwired to basically say, when I walk in my house, I see all of the things that I wish. I see what could be. I could see that my kitchen could be nicer. I could see that this could be nicer. I can see, and I'm striving to get it there. But then they forget to enjoy their house on the path to trying to fix things up. And even when it's 90% there, they're like, I still need to change out that window. I still want to change it. They're not enjoying all of the things that they've worked. And other people very naturally are like, you know what? I'm pretty content with what it is. And I'd like to make it better. And I'd like to fix it up, but I enjoy it now as is. If you come back to your initial question of, right, like, can people change personality traits? You can't inherently wake up one day and say, you know what? I want to walk into my house and just be totally content with everything exactly how it is. Still want to fix it up. Still want to make it nicer. But just, you can't just say to somebody, hey, you know what? Wouldn't it be more fun if you could just enjoy the house exactly as it is right now in this moment? Still want to fix it up and not feel bad about it? Every single person would go, yeah, oh, I would love that. You can't just snap your fingers and change that. You can work on it. You can work on it to say, right, okay, I know the house isn't what I want it to be. And I know I want to fix stuff up. And I know it's going to take me longer than I wish it could. And I know I want it done tomorrow. But I have to combat that. I have to accept that that's how I feel. I have to accept that, like, yeah, I'm somebody who is absolutely going to see what I would like done differently. And then I have to work on seeing the things that I do enjoy. I have to push myself not to just say, like, great, I fixed up this one room and it looks great. Some people are like, but now I don't even see that room. Now I see that room as almost more of a backdrop of, ugh, okay, that one room looks great and all the other rooms look awful. So now that one room that you fixed up and made look amazing actually serves as like a negative litmus test of the, like, yep, compared to that one room, everything else is awful. It takes work to say, all right, I am somebody who naturally sees what I would like done next, but I have to force myself to see everything that I've done. I need to force myself to see, right? Like, you know, you and I talked about that, or I think I had sent you an overly long text message at one point where I gave you the unfiltered thought I had about this notion of, like, you know, people who, if you imagine yourself as a house, who are like, ooh, like this thing started off rough neighborhood, like, who fix it up, always still see themselves as the old broken down house, even if their house is amazing and other people are jealous of it. They still see themselves as the, like, nah, I've just put nice window dressing up and it's all pretend because I know what it used to be, and can't get past that idea that they've built themselves into something that other people envy and other people love and other people, they still kind of see, they're like, oh no, it's not great. You know? And I think that is the big part of trying to figure out a way to say, right, it's okay for me to want things to be better. It's okay for me to want to work or strive. But if everything between now and then kind of blinds me to all that I've done, if it blinds you to all of the positives, all of that you've built, all the, because it's either there or it's not there, then you torture yourself. And if you are somebody who naturally is like, oh, I don't want to walk into my house and see the negatives. Okay, well, just saying I'm going to stop, that doesn't work. That's like, that. Imagine how much easier, you know, the world of therapy would be if you could just be like, oh, well, have you considered just not doing that? Oh, that's it? Like, oh, I'm really anxious when I get on a plane. Oh, have you tried flying not anxious? Oh, I'd never thought about that. Thanks.
Have you tried just being happy to a depressed person?
Right. Like, and I think I made a video about that once where I was like, emotions aren't like picking an outfit. It's not like some people wake up and they're like, you know, I'm going to go with happy and content. And somebody else is like, you know what? I'm going to go with self-conscious and like a little bit lonely. Like, we don't just pick it. It's not like a, but being able to say, yeah, I'm somebody who naturally sees what I want to do. I'm somebody who naturally sees what isn't fixed yet. I'm somebody who naturally sees what could be better. Okay. Well, then the trick in my mind is accepting that, all right, you see those things. And now the work is, how do I also see the good? I have to force myself to say, yeah, it's not a ignore the bad and see the good. No, it's being able to say, right, I need to just accept that I'm probably always going to feel like there's something I want to tweak, something I want to fix, something I want to make a little bit better. But also, how do I celebrate my accomplishments? How do I celebrate the things I have done? How do I accept compliments for the things that I have changed, fixed, altered, you know, that people are like, wow, that looks great. How do I get to a point where I could say, you know, thank you. Like, I've worked really hard on that. And there's a lot more I want to do. But instead of just saying, oh, God, like, I know, but have you seen this, that? Some people just can't even pause to say, you know what? I do feel like proud of myself for what I did. They just skip right past that and go to like, ooh, don't tell me what you think is impressive. Like, because my gut is that that means you haven't looked around to see all the other stuff that isn't. What? Like, yeah, we all have that.
You know, it's such a house of cards. And I think one thing I would love to hear you dive into a little bit, because when you say do the work, and this is one thing I used to think I was doing right, was that doing the work was doing, like actively doing new shit, trying new things, working harder at something, like the actual tactical physical output, versus when people say do the work, that's not always physical doing. And so that's where, for me, as a natural kind of action taker, problem solver, kind of ambitious person, you tell me to do the work and I'm like, what fucking suffering do I need to go through next? Like, throw me into the fire. I will burn, baby. Until I realized that that was some of the problem, was that that doing was more of an avoidance versus almost learning to be. That was the hard work that I had to do. And because it's not actually doing, like from a physical perspective, I think that when you tell people who, and maybe this is just my own, maybe I don't think I'm one of one, but I do think there are other people that will hear do the work and they'll think, what do I need to do? What action do I need to take? Instead of understanding that it's a, not an overnight thing. You can't run it like you run a marathon. Like, that might take you 4 hours. This is going to take you 4 years. Like, so what, if you could break that down to what does that mean to do the work from your perspective, especially as somebody who works in a therapeutic setting, what does that actually mean?
You mean how do we straight up identify and put out like a breakout list? Not going to happen because it's so different for everybody. Right. So, and I'm not, this isn't a cop out, for one, I love that, because what you said is I don't think you're alone. I think a lot of people will hear do the work. And what I love about this, both literally and figuratively, and I guess we can play it back, I'm fairly sure I never said you have to do the work. I said it takes work.
I literally am going to play this back, because if you said it takes work and I heard do the work, that just already tells you where my brain is at.
No, but, and I also, you're not alone, right? And now we're getting into semantics, because we could argue saying it takes a lot of work is basically the same as saying you have to do the work, because it is. But when I say it takes work, what I was talking about before is when I mean it takes work, it takes work to be able to really identify this, to really be able to say, I need to be honest with myself. I need to be able to acknowledge the things that I do well. I need to be able to acknowledge the areas that I struggle with. I need to be very, very honest with myself about what works and what doesn't, right? Changing behavior becomes impossible if you can't even admit or acknowledge or identify the challenge. You know, I think I put something up about this recently where I was saying, and I used dumb examples. I actually got some great messages where people were like, okay, you picked like three things that I exactly have issues with. I feel very called out, like in a funny way. But like, I said things like, right, if you have trouble returning Amazon packages and for some reason you're always doing it last minute, well, if you can't say to yourself, oh yeah, I don't know why I struggle with that, you're not going to change it. If you're like, no, it's just that once. It's not that bad. Only, how can you change it if you can't say to yourself, I don't know why, but like, I hate doing it. You know, if you kind of can't admit to yourself that saying no is hard, right? And if you say, no, like I'm getting better at it. And, you know, I do say no more often. And it's really like, it's got, well, if I'm trying to convince myself it's gotten better and that it's okay. And that, you know, I do say yes sometimes when I don't want to, but there's a reason for, if I can't just admit to myself, yeah, I have a hard time with that. Well, then I can't change it. So sometimes the kind of the work is being able to say, one, I have to really be honest with myself. And I was joking, you know, recently about, you know, people who get hangry, you know, who when they haven't eaten, get the number of people who are in that category who just can't admit, like, yeah, if my blood sugar is low or if I haven't eaten, I get mad, I get cranky. And it's like, why can't you just admit that? Because, and those are always the people where they're like, can we go already? How can we just eat something? And they're like, no, we're leaving. We're about to have, if they could just say to themselves, yeah, when I'm hungry, I get, you know, and my battery's low, I get more frustrated, more cranky, more. So I have to eat regularly. But if you can't just admit to yourself, yeah, I don't know why, but like when I'm hungry, like I'm a bear. Well, I can't change the behavior if I can't admit it. So the first part is trying to be, to try and figure out like, if there are areas you want differently, it's a, how can I be honest with myself about some of the things that are tough? And that doesn't mean it's a deficit. Doesn't mean that it's something you do wrong. Doesn't mean, it just means you have to be able to say to yourself, like, yeah, that's an area I struggle. Some people do, some people don't. And then I think we all have our default. And when you try and change your default, it's uncomfortable. Right? So if you struggle with saying no to things, what happens is people will be like, oh, well, first you have to be able to admit to yourself, yeah, that's hard for me. I feel guilty. I feel badly. If I can't say that, no, that's not an issue, then I can't even identify it. And then when somebody says, hey, you know, can you come help me move? Well, what happens is you say no. It's immediately uncomfortable. It's, I think of it almost like having an itch where you're like, oh, okay, I got to scratch it. It's the only way to make it better. Only way to make it better is scratch. Like, so what people do is they say no. And then they're like, you know what? I think I can move something around. I can come and help. Oh, you get immediate relief, right? It's scratching that itch. But guess what? If you scratch an itch, it won't go away, right? It will always be there. And actually, the more you scratch it, the worse it gets. So the work is sometimes trying to, starting by identifying the problem. What is the issue that you have trouble with or you want to, and no self-judgment, just saying like, yeah, why can't I just admit to myself this is something I struggle with? So first is trying to identify the, this is what I'd like to change and I have to admit it honestly. The next part is knowing that changing the behavior is going to be uncomfortable. So it means when you get that tingle, when you get that itch, it's learning to say, yep, I identify it and I'm not going to scratch it. And at first, it's incredibly uncomfortable. And people will sit there and be like, nope, stick to it. Nope, stick to it. And then they're like, ah, I caved. You have to push through that part multiple times to be like, right, saying no makes me feel guilty. Okay, well, am I going to cave to that guilt? Or am I going to say, right, but I should be able to say no without feeling guilty?
So I have a few thoughts on just that in general. So I think first, one thing that I've noticed is that oftentimes we can have awareness over something being problematic. We don't always have awareness over how many layers deeper the actual reason is that we function in a certain way versus kind of the surface level things that we can identify that we're like, oh, that's the problem. Oh, that's the problem. Oh, that's the problem. And then we're like, oh, I'm just going to change this. But when you have this almost like learned behavior that is triggered and activated due to an interpersonal dynamic or relationship dynamics in which you've lived underneath or experienced or lived out, that even though it is not ideal due to the internal world that you experience as a consequence to it, aka you didn't want to do it, it doesn't feel good, the understanding that they will be happy with you kind of reinforces that, right? Positive reinforcement, even if internally that feels uncomfortable. So in the moment where you go to make a different decision for yourself, oftentimes in the right, the build up to the moment in which you have to make this decision or take this action, you catastrophize the outcome. So you're already getting into worst case scenario. They're going to hate me. They're never going to talk to me again. Right? They're never going to, whatever the fear is that you have that catastrophizes the situation, even if objectively you can acknowledge that the odds that that actually happens is minimal, you still go right to that direction, which can then cause you to continue to itch this thing, making the wound worse. And I think underlying all of that, this is why, if I were to speculate, I haven't looked into the research on this, but this seems to me why meditation is so powerful for people, because you're controlling an impulse that you have, whether it's thoughts, whether it's blinking or moving or, you know, fidgeting or kind of silencing things or not feeding into a thought. Because a lot of people say you can control thoughts. I don't necessarily believe that. I think that you can control whether or not you engage with them or not. But I don't think that every thought that we have is within our control. And so it's unlearning or having the awareness over the fact that you catastrophize certain things and you always think, what is the worst possible nuclear bomb situation of this? And you go right to that direction when there's many different microcosms that will likely have a higher probability of happening versus the thing that you fear the most. And then really playing out, well, even if the worst case scenario were to happen, would I be okay? And so through meditation, or at least moving through the experiences that you have and then coming out the other side of them, you realize everything is fine. Nothing blew up. I'm still okay. I feel better now. And I think that level of regulation is important, especially when you're trying to work through somebody who maybe is more on the neurotic side or just feels their emotions to a point where they autopilot into certain behaviors that may be maladaptive in the long term for them.
Yeah, we might need a part two on this
one. Okay.
You know, I think that what everybody's approach to behavior change is, again, going to be different for each person. For some people, they want to break it all the way down, right? To where did this start? Where did it stem from? So I can understand it at a depth. That the problem with that is that doesn't work for all issues, because there's a certain amount of data that we lose over time. Things that happen to us in early childhood where it's almost like, right, we don't have enough storage space. Like if you think of it almost like a hard drive where it's like there's a finite amount of storage. So at some point things get consolidated, some things get thrown out, some things are like file sizes decreased. So you lose some, you know, detail or some. So you can't always just go back to the, where was this created? It's also possible that it's so nuanced, you'll never know all of the variables and all the facets that helped lead to it. But some people with some topics or some issues need to do that. They need to go all the way back to the beginning and see if they can trace some component of how did I get here. For other people, other issues, other topics, it's more of a, this is what's plaguing me now. So let me start with the, how do I address the current issue as it's impacting my current life? And then as I start to get a handle on that, work backwards to try and have a better understanding of the origin. There's no one right way to go. It depends on the individual, the topic, the...
And what I think is, I guess I want to make sure that like my position was articulated appropriately, but I think not necessarily the memory, because like I don't really have a negative memory that aligns with a lot of the stuff. I find that it boils down to a belief or like an description of my own person or my what I'm supposed to do, how I'm supposed to function, what I need to do or who I need to be relative to an internal narrative around my identity. And so I don't know that, like you said, I don't think that we can store things. I know I can't recall a lot of things from my childhood. So it's hard for me to go down that path, but I don't know. This is like, so I have so many questions about the complexity of our own being and our own nature, but I wonder if that there's, whether it's like physiological cells or almost the emotional triggers that we have activate not necessarily the memory itself or whatever the circumstance was that you experienced, but that's almost like the emotion triggers the thing. And again, there's behaviors, or we post-rationalize why we did certain things or why that had to make sense, or we justify certain things in hindsight as to why we behave the way that we do, notwithstanding or understanding the depth of that really comes down to a core belief that we have. And then we can get into shattered assumptions and things like that. But I see it more from that. It's like, even if you say it out loud, like there are certain things that I am still working through talking about because I'm not sure I can say them out loud because I don't know the gravity of that statement and how it would impact me on an emotional place or plane. But I think a lot of that investigating those, the depth of why I feel that way in the context of the situation. I also find that situations or the context in which something happens isn't necessarily the root. And when I say root, I find human behavior in itself follows a line of principle. So that's where the predictability comes in. It may not be the same situation that you experience, almost like learning to navigate a difficult conversation, right? I might have a difficult conversation with you or my parents or my best friend or a relationship partner, but the ability to do that underlies a similar fashion of humility and learning from them, listening to them without making assumptions or projecting my own needs or assuming that they know what my needs are and kind of tabling all of those things that we tend to do to have an open and honest conversation, to be able to hear them and what they're saying versus how I can kind of mind bend that based on an internal narrative that I have about myself. And I think that is where the complexity comes down to. I think it boils down into internal beliefs that we have or narratives that we've taken on that may not be rooted in reality whatsoever. But the paradigm is that that's also what drives us to behave in certain ways.
Absolutely. I mean, and the ability to, like, listen, when you can at least identify it, it obviously makes it easier because we have God knows how many different things, internal narratives, rule systems that we operate on, and we don't even know. They're just how we learned how to operate. It's like the rules that we learn, the things that half of them we don't even know are there. But if you've identified something in your life that you would like to change or causes you distress, right? Well, now we at least know the distress point. We at least know the challenge point. That doesn't mean you immediately have access to how did we get here. But it's why it's often where I start with just I'd rather start with the concrete, what is the thing that's bothering you or the thing that stresses you out or the thing that you would like to be able to do differently. That's going to give me an easier roadmap to where do we want to go. And the whole idea so two things that you had said that I want to come back to is one, the idea of thought blocking, thought stopping, just preventing yourself from having a thought. It's insane, right? I mean, we all have automatic thoughts, and I can't remember if we've talked about this before, but I often will joke around and say, like, if you picture there are little versions of you in your own head, like a boardroom, and they're wearing a sports jersey, and on the back it says like what their role is, right? So there's, you know, there's sadness and there's, you know, humor and there's intellect and, you know, there's worry, there's anxiety. These are all characters in the brain. There is one character that is basically what I think of or refer to as an unfiltered character that just says exactly what they're thinking with zero filter all the time. Lots of the other characters hate this person because they're like, hey, we all know it. But stop saying it out loud, because once you say it out loud, it's like all of a sudden we end up in the boardroom and we got to figure out what to do. And the example I always use is, okay, if I decided yesterday, I'm going to give up sugar, not sugar in foods, but anything that is purely 100% sugar, I'm giving up. Okay. Well, if I walk into the office and somebody has put out a bowl of candy, it is the unfiltered character that's going to go, ooh, candy. That's it. I can't stop that from happening. that character is going to say that whether I like it or not. I can't stop it. I didn't know there was going to be candy there. I can't shut the unfiltered character up. What gets people in trouble is that very often what happens is intellect wants to shut it down, right? In that moment, you know, the unfiltered character goes, ooh, candy. And intellect goes, hey, no, we cannot eat that. Okay. Well, now I have these two characters that are butting heads. They're fighting. If one of them can't give, if one of them can't acknowledge reality, then here's what's going to happen. The unfiltered character is going to go, what are you talking about? It's just candy. We cannot eat it. Okay. Well, now unfiltered is going to go, of course we can. I'm an adult and I have arms and it's clearly for everybody. If the intellect keeps saying, nope, absolutely not. What happens is that unfiltered character is going to go, okay, I can't reason with you. So I'm just going to prove that I'm right. And before you know it, I'm going to eat two or three pieces of candy. And then that's when guilt walks in the room and goes, what are you doing? We just said we weren't going to do that. We don't even like candy. If we were going to waste the calories, why wouldn't we do it on something else? And all the other characters go, oh, shit. Yeah, that's right. That would have made sense. It's trying to teach your intellect character not to get in that fight, but to say, yeah, it's candy. I see it. And it tastes good. But remember, we just decided we were going to try and give that up. And if we're going to break it on day one, like we should at least do it with something we love. That will get that unfiltered character to go, yeah, yeah, it makes sense.
What I literally am picturing in my mind right now is almost like the childlike part of our being is the character that just says anything, because kids are just unfiltered all the time. They just say what they think, what they feel. Oh, look at that. They're like, oh yeah, I want some of that. Oh, there's candy over there. Oh, there's a dog. Can we pet it? Mm-hmm. And it's almost like as you grow and mature, you are conditioned to behave in a certain way. And so it almost means you shut that part of you off. But the problem with that impulsive character, just like a child, is when you tell them not to do something, they will do it. Even if they don't like it. I remember my mom used to make Brussels sprouts when I was a kid. She loved them. We'd hated them. And the moment that she told me I couldn't have Brussels sprouts was the moment I had to eat all of them. It was like the dumbest thing in the world. I didn't actually want them, but it was almost like telling myself I couldn't means that I had to. And I think this is the hardest thing for most people to conceptualize, is that two things can be true at the same time. You can have candy available and it can be delicious. And also you cannot eat it in that moment because it doesn't align with your current goals right now. And that's okay. And I think once you get into a place where you can see both sides and also go, yeah, and that's not better or worse. It just is an option. And I'm choosing to engage with it or I'm choosing not to. And either way is totally acceptable. It's totally fine.
That is, I say nearly verbatim what you said, I don't know, 10 times a week. You know, it's the whole idea of cognitive dissonance. The brain internally, we don't like when we have opposite thoughts. And so, you know, if you get invited to something and you say no, okay, well, here's what happens. In the brain, if I go, you know, and I'm, you know, there's no easy way to convey the visual, but, you know, basically the idea is my brain goes, hey, I know it's the right choice not to go. Well, but I feel bad. Those two things don't line up. The brain wants them to line up. So, well, the brain then goes, well, if I know it's the right thing, I shouldn't feel bad. Well, but I do feel bad. I shouldn't my way out of feeling badly. So the brain goes, but I do feel bad. And then it goes, uh-oh, well, then maybe I should go. And it goes, nope, I know the right thing is to not go. And it goes, well, but then why do I feel bad? And these two things will literally chase themselves. And the trick is exactly what you're saying. It's in recognizing both are true. I can know it's the right thing for me to not go and also feel bad.
This literally
and
brings
that's
me
okay.
back. Yeah, this brings me back to relationships, because the hardest thing I've ever had to do, one of the hardest things, is when I truly loved somebody, but I knew they weren't good for me. And then making that decision to walk away from it. I was heartbroken about it. Absolutely. But I still knew it was the right thing to do. And that's that internal judgment that you have of like, this is the right thing. What you shouldn't feel sad about it. You shouldn't be heartbroken over it. Like it's that I shouldn't. It's like, then you invalidate the feeling and that just perpetuates the suffering that you go through. I have had the series of the longest heartbreak chronicles in the world, because I fight myself on how I feel and being able to process those feelings, because logically I can identify that that was the right decision to make. But yeah. I feel bad about it. And so it's like this.
And I had that conversation with somebody recently where I was saying, hey, you can care about somebody. And you can love them even. And also not know that you can't be together. And people get thrown off because it's like, well, that doesn't make sense. If I love the person and care about them, you know, well, then now what? But I don't want to be with them, or it's not. So it's the right thing to separate, but I miss them and I feel badly and I care about them. Those two things don't line up. So people say, okay, well, then maybe breaking up was the wrong thing. And then they go, no, it was the right thing. And it's like, well, but then I shouldn't miss them. And I shouldn't. The gap between those two things is where guilt and indecision festers. It is like its optimal growing, you know, like environment. It's reminding yourself, yeah, both can be true. I can miss them and be sad that the relationship's over and also still know it's the right thing for me. They're both true. One's not right. One's not wrong. They're both true. It's just kind of the reality of it. And trying to get to a place where you can do that, where you can say, right, okay. Yeah. I know this isn't the right call. Or, you know, I know I need to make this change and I feel sad. When you can acknowledge that, that's when it makes it easier to start to change the behavior and to start to change those patterns, to be able to say, right, okay, so, you know, I know this job isn't good for me, you know, but I'm really freaked out about leaving. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. But then what happens is when that unfiltered character starts saying, like, what if we can't find another job? Okay. Everybody else gets all frustrated because they're like, hey, stop saying that. Okay, well, that doesn't help anybody. You don't have to stop saying it. Like, in fact, you have to say, yeah, of course I'm worried that I'm not going to get another job. But, like, why can't we just validate that worry? The problem is, and I think we've talked about this, that when that unfiltered character says something, if you have a worry or an anxiety character, and then also a creativity character, those characters, when they link arms, are really problematic. Because I feel like what happens is the unfiltered character says, what happens if we can't find another job? Or if that job's worse? And anxiety pokes her head and goes, I don't know, what does happen? And then they call in, you know, creativity and go, what do you think could happen? Some people, their creativity character, not creative. Right? Right? So they go, hey, what do you think could happen? And they go, I don't know. And you're like, no, but seriously, if we quit this job, what do you think could happen? And they go, I don't know. But, like, you know, didn't you say we were miserable? Yeah. Well, then I guess we'll find out when it happens. No. But what other people's creativity character is like super excited, over caffeinated, very creative, and like walks around with like a drafting board and is like, ooh, I don't know. And they just start coming up with this could happen, this could happen, this could happen. Disaster. Then they rip that page off, they put it on the wall, and they come up with another one and another one and another, and they just keep going until your walls are plastered. You don't even have to read all the bullets because in big bold letters at the bottom, it says like disaster, I have to move out of my house. Like I'll end up homeless. Like I won't. So you can just see the tagline. The problem is none of those are true. Those are all made up.
The catastrophizing feature of the brain.
Right. Exactly. But imagine if you are sitting at your computer and nobody else can see it, you know, on Zoom, but the walls all around you out of their view are just all plastered with disaster, horror, this, that. You're telling me it doesn't mess with you? That it doesn't mess with your phone, even though not a single one of those are true. They're all made up. And that's where I think, yeah, it starts when there's this argument. It starts when there's this internal argument of, I don't want to think about that. Don't feel that. Don't say that. It's learning to start by saying, yeah, of course I know why the unfiltered character thinks that. It makes perfect sense. And now with that, let's figure out what we can do next. That's the tough part.
Josh, this was amazing. Thank you so much for your time. We're going to have to do a part two on this. But I appreciate you always, your perspective and your shared knowledge around all the things that you do and the amazing things, the way you support people like me and obviously all the people that you serve. So we will dive into part two. If you guys listen to this and you have questions that you want us to cover relative to the topics that we dove into today, please feel free to reach out to me or Josh. You can find us on social media. I'll link all of those things below. And Josh, I will talk to you next week.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.